Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The Endangered Species Act became law 50 years ago. Since then, hundreds of species have been put under its protection. Wyoming and the West is home to many of them. We're taking time this week to tell the stories of a few of the fish, insects, and mammals that call the state home. We'll learn about a tiny fish that only lives in a 1,000-foot stretch of stream in western Wyoming and nowhere else.
We go back and forth on wanting to draw attention to a really unique and cool species and wanting to protect it.
A small toad that was thought to be extinct is now making a comeback.
We kind of like your land, and we think in this case, it may be suitable for the Wyoming toad.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to a special Open Spaces, recognizing the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Today, we're taking a look at a few species in Wyoming affected by the Endangered Species Act. Let's start with some background about the Endangered Species Act, or also known as ESA. Why did it first pass? What does the law even do? And why does it matter? To start the show, I talked with Wyoming Public Media reporter Will Walkie about the past, present, and future of the ESA. All right, Will, can you take us back to 1973? Why was there a push for the Endangered Species Act, and what was the goal of the law back then?
So the Endangered Species Act came in response to growing awareness of environmental issues that came about in the 60s. Americans were becoming increasingly concerned about animals and plants around the country going extinct because of threats from industry hunting, deforestation, things like that. The near eradication of bison from the continent in the late 1800s and early 1900s, huge wake-up call for this. And we realized, yeah, humans actually can wipe out a species from the planet. And in the mid-20th century, extinction rates were up. Another animal that was probably another wake-up call for Americans, got a lot more Americans on board with conservation efforts, was the bald eagle. In the early 60s, it was estimated that there were just 500 breeding pairs remaining in the lower 48. Today, there are hundreds of thousands, so it was really low back then. Anyway, at that point, the main groups preserving animals were maybe zoos, other private nonprofit organizations, and there were a few early iterations of like other species protection acts, but it wasn't until the late 60s and early 70s that there was a real nationwide push that the government should get involved in a major way. And one of the leaders in this was President Richard Nixon. That's a name that kind of surprised me and might surprise other people. He was actually a huge environmentalist. Here he is talking about the importance of passing laws like the Endangered Species Act. This was in 1972.
Each of us all across this great land has a stake in maintaining and improving environmental quality, clean air and clean water, the wise use of our land, the protection of wildlife and natural beauty, parks for all to enjoy. These are part of the birthright of every American. To guarantee that birthright, we must act, and act decisively. It is literally now or never.
So in 1973, Congress passes the Endangered Species Act. It was nearly unanimous, and then Nixon signed it. It was broadly popular and still is, but of course has some controversies attached to it.
Right. So before we get to those controversies, what does the Endangered Species Act do, and what is its record?
Okay, so what does the Endangered Species Act do? It lets the federal government list a particular animal or plant as either threatened or endangered. That listing decision is usually controversial or much discussed, especially in the West. But once something does become listed, federal agencies can designate a critical habitat zone. What that does is it limits things like energy development in the area. The feds then take control of management from states, and then it becomes a national thing where the species is listed online as an endangered or threatened species. Really, then the feds have a lot of power. The ultimate goal there is preventing extinction and allowing the species to recover. And I gotta say, in many ways, the ESA has been successful in 50 years. 99% of the species that have been listed haven't gone extinct, and there are more than 1,300 species now listed, including some really charismatic animals like the grizzly bear or the gray wolf, the spotted owl or Florida panther. Those are some other examples of well-known species on the list. But it also protects less lesser known, things like fish, bugs, bats, reptiles, you know, animals that might not have those huge Facebook pages or online presence, but they still play a part in ecosystems. They're still really important, and the ESA just doesn't discriminate based on how well-known a species is.
Got it. And although it's been doing a good job of keeping species from going extinct, what are some issues with the ESA?
Yeah, really important to note some of the issues. And it does get back to the goals of the ESA. You know, when it was signed, it wasn't just about preventing extinction. It's also allowing, well, it's supposed to allow animals to recover to the point where they are then delisted, where we say, yeah, you're fine. You're now back to what things were like before you were threatened or endangered. It turns out that doesn't really happen very often. In fact, in the history of the ESA, only about 54 species have ever been delisted. Only 56 have been downgraded from the endangered level to the lesser threatened level. So a lot of species are added to the list and then they just stay there. And that can be frustrating, not just for environmental groups who want to see them recover, but also for states like Wyoming. They want to see control come back to the state level, and the future of the ESA is really going to be about recovery. Another thing to mention is that the ESA is just a really complicated law. How the law works depends on the species, and there are lawsuits, there are often petitions associated with each plant and each animal. This can bog down the Fish and Wildlife Service. I talked with Temple Stollinger, she's a law professor with the University of Wyoming, about some of the needs for more reforms within the law.
You know, funding to both the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service is going to be increasingly important moving forward, you know, giving them the resources they need to not only to continue to conserve species, but also think about, you know, actions that are needed to recover species and remove them from the Endangered Species Act. I think also we've done a lot of work on thinking about how to sort of be reactionary in conserving species. So I think, you know, there's an opportunity to look at some of the tools under the Endangered Species Act to be a bit more flexible and maybe a bit more proactive moving forward. So how can we kind of get ahead of again, the need to sort of quickly and immediately worry about, you know, species that are approaching, you know, that threshold of needing federal help and, you know, on the verge of extinction.
How do Wyoming politicians feel about the Endangered Species Act? Do they agree that changes need to be made?
So Wyoming leaders, they're some of the most vocal, I don't want to say opponents, but maybe critics of the ESA. They have been like this over the past few decades. A lot of that comes down to management of hot button carnivores like grizzly bears and wolves, but also things like sage grouse and other species that inhabit Wyoming. It should be noted that western states are particularly impacted by the ESA, and that's because so many species live here. We have a lot of intact ecosystems, a lot of wildlife corridors, and a lot of open spaces. We also have a lot of federal land where these species live. So a lot of people here probably feel like species policies and decisions maybe target Western states. And maybe a lot of people say they're made by East Coast bureaucrats who don't really understand the actual impacts of something like a grizzly bear on the ground. Here's Governor Mark Gordon testifying before Congress a few years ago. He says the ESA is well-intentioned, but definitely needs changes.
Unfortunately, Wyoming also has a long history of being hamstrung with paying for species management, yet being obliged to defer to federal government on decisions about that management. This is particularly vexing when species have fully recovered, yet remain listed because of legal horseplay and judicial jousting. Rather than focusing on actual results, courts are asked to speculate on what ifs that lead to a vicious cycle.
Other Wyoming politicians have also questioned the Endangered Species Act recently, and especially whether or not certain animals should be listed. It's becoming more and more divisive among party lines. A lot of Republicans say the ESA is constricting the states' rights, and then some Democrats say these sorts of narratives threaten the integrity of this environmental law. This is really different from when the ESA passed 50 years ago. Again, it was almost unanimous back then, and I am speculating here, but I don't think something like the ESA could pass today. Now it feels like how the ESA works is just subject to that back and forth nature of whatever color the administration is a part of. The Trump administration looked to weaken ESA protections and delist species, and now the Biden administration wants to restore those protections. So when the ESA was passed, it really wasn't supposed to be this way. The law says we should be making decisions based on science for the best interest of the animal or plant. And nowadays it feels like business and politics and money is inevitably getting involved when it probably shouldn't be. And that's especially true when we're talking about what the word recovery actually means. Again, recovery is going to be so important in the next 50 years of the ESA, and the word recovery means something different for each person.
All right. Well, Will Waukee, thank you so much for talking to us about Endangered Species Act.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to hear some specific stories about some of these species that Will mentioned, like the grizzly bear and the wolf. This is Open Spaces. There's a fish that only lives in one body of water in the entire world, and it's in western Wyoming. It's been on the endangered species list since it was passed, 50 years ago, and not that many people know about it. In fact, for this story, there was really only one person qualified to talk about the fish. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, that person is a young, passionate biologist who's made it her mission to keep the fish from disappearing altogether. Take a listen.
We just drove onto the Bridge of Teton National Forest.
I'm driving with Kate Olson on a bumpy road in the Upper Green on a crisp fall day. Olson is in her 30s. She's wearing a blue skirt with leggings so she can hike around.
Oh, I like the pink. Yeah, very fun.
I just got my hair cut today, so the pink is more hidden.
But the main thing about Olson is she's a fish biologist for the Forest Service and loves and knows all things fish. 7 years ago, she had never heard of the Kendall Warm Springs Dace.
Which so many people don't even know. People who live in this county don't even know the species exists.
And now she manages it, a tiny fish that only exists in a 1,000-foot stream in the Upper Green. And its future largely falls on her shoulders.
The balance is always like, am I having a panic attack today? Or
yeah, stressful.
Yeah.
We're driving through an open sagebrush valley. The Green River carves through the landscape, and the Wind River Range towers over.
So we just crossed this cattle guard, and there's a fence around the entire, it's called a Kendall Warm Springs Special Interest Area.
It surrounds 1,000 feet of shallow stream that's always about 85 degrees. It's fed by a geothermal hot spring. It's home to the endangered fish. We're parked off a small bridge that goes over the warm springs, but you wouldn't really know an endangered species lives here.
It's a little cryptic, and we go back and forth on wanting to draw attention to a really unique and cool species and wanting to protect it.
Basically, they don't want people wading in the water, disrupting the fish. We walk through some sagebrush and get to a 15-foot waterfall that separates the warm springs from the river.
It looks almost tropical. Like, it looks almost like you're in Hawaii or something. And so it feels so out of place.
The waterfall formed after glaciers receded about 15,000 years ago.
And when it was first starting, you know, the waterfall was 6 inches high, and then it was 12 inches high.
And at that point, the fish was actually just the more common speckled dace, a fish that's thriving and is found from Canada to Mexico. But as the waterfall got taller,
the fish could no longer move between warm spring and river. And at that point, they then started to evolve into their own subspecies of speckled dace.
Essentially, the fish got trapped and evolved into the Kendall Warm Springs dace, living upstream of the waterfall, separate from all the foot-long trout just below in the river.
There's like 10 fish over a foot long in there. Every day I go in the field and I think, why don't you bring your fly rod for your lunch break? Sorry, you were asking a question and obviously I got distracted by fish.
Oh, you're okay.
But upstream in the warm springs, we still haven't seen any of those rare fish that we're here to see.
See that light colored sandy pebble bottom there? Just had 5 or 6 of them darting around.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So an adult fish. Yep, there was one. That was an adult fish maxing out in that 1.5 to 2 inch neighborhood.
The Warm Springs dace is olive colored, and the youngins are teeny tiny.
I refer to them as fingernail clippings because they're about that size and they're transparent.
Olson says the population has declined for at least 20 years. We don't really know why, but a couple years ago, she and another fish biologist were looking at the warm springs and saw something green.
I think this is watercress, and then we were both like, is that not native?
The watercress is an invasive species. It looks like microgreens growing across the stream, forcing the water to flow faster and through smaller channels, possibly hurting the fish.
Yeah, we did our best to remove 100% of the watercress from the system last year.
Oh, really?
Yep. So what you're looking at here is an answer to a question about how quickly it recolonizes.
It's everywhere. So Olson says the next big project is figuring out the best way to remove it. As we're about to head back to the truck, Olson wants to make sure she mentioned all her favorite things about the dace. She leafs through her green notebook that's neatly organized with tabs.
I wanted to make sure I used the word endemic. It's a good word for people to know.
Why do you feel like endemic is crucial?
Endemic means something lives here and nowhere else. And that is the part for dace anyways that just feels like this is just such an exceptional species to work with and manage.
And with that, we bid the Kendall Warm Springs dace goodbye and drive back out. Now, one might question, surely a few fish must swim off that waterfall and into the river below. But Olson's already considered this.
My guess is they get chomped, chomped, chomped.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in the Upper Green.
Up next on Open Spaces, we look at what's going on with two of the more well-known and controversial species that have been listed on the ESA. Welcome back to a special Open Spaces on the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. Gray wolves are one of the most controversial animals protected in the West, and how you manage the species depends on where you're standing. Wyoming Public Radio's Will Walkie reports from one area where that friction is a part of daily life.
The Little Snake River crosses the Wyoming-Colorado border at least a dozen times on its westward journey. The river's valley is agricultural. Goats, sheep, and cattle graze next to schools and churches. Bob Davis is a rancher and a member of the Wyoming legislature. He has friends in both states.
And we don't notice that there's a border between Wyoming and Colorado here. We're neighbors up and down this border.
He says you always have to be ready here to protect your herd from predators like wolves. His son just bought several 190-pound dogs for protection.
You go to the store and you buy a sack of dog food for Fido. Well, we buy a pallet for the sheepdogs.
But in this part of Wyoming, a wolf can also be shot on site without a license.
There's different rules, different laws. So if there's a wolf that is on the Wyoming side, he is fair game.
It's different over the border, where wolves are protected by state and federal endangered species laws. Colorado plans to reintroduce the predators around the I-70 corridor near Vail later this year, but wolves are already in the state. Grainy Facebook video shows wolves roaming around North Park, about 25 miles from the Wyoming border and a couple hours' drive from the Little Snake River Valley. North Park rancher Philip Anderson is not a fan of reintroduction. Wolves can travel as much as 30 miles in a day, and he's worried about them killing his cattle.
When you see pictures or you see animals that have been depredated on or crippled because of depredation, it makes you wonder about your bottom line.
States often reimburse ranchers who lose livestock to wolves, but Anderson says applying can be cumbersome and the money's not always enough. So he and his neighbors have tried deterrents like guard donkeys, fences, lights, and even propane cannons. Still, some livestock and pets have been killed in North Park. What Anderson wants is a policy like Wyoming's.
I can see the use of wolves to control those ungulates of wildlife, but I can't see them introduced without some ability to control them for stock growers. And we wonder sometimes why we have to try to reinvent the wheel in Colorado, because we don't have to.
Colorado says it will allow some lethal control of wolves that harass livestock. Michael Robinson with the environmental group Center for Biological Diversity says ranchers should rarely kill wolves and never on public lands.
It's important to distinguish natural losses that take place on public lands should be part of the cost of doing business from some sense of illegitimate losses.
Wolves account for a very small percentage of cattle losses in places like Idaho. Robinson says the apex predators have been a part of the West for thousands of years, and they help control other wildlife populations.
At this point, the livestock industry needs to compromise with the public interest in restoring these beautiful, social, intelligent animals to play their vital ecological role in the forests, in the canyons, in the grasslands of western Colorado.
Robinson's also pushing to update Wyoming's laws to be friendlier to wildlife. He says when a pack crosses an invisible border and can be hunted down, it hurts reintroduction efforts. Temple Stollinger is a University of Wyoming law professor. She says one area of compromise could be more lucrative financial support for ranchers.
Maybe there's an opportunity for incentives to come into play, and maybe the conservation community could offer that landowner incentive payments or habitat conservation payments to keep wolves on their landscape.
She recently returned from Europe, which has its own cross-border wolf issues. Thousands live in Italy, and some cross into France, Switzerland, or Austria.
So there's a lot of border dynamics with carnivore and wolf management in particular in Europe right now. And there's different levels of social tolerance.
Just like in the U.S., wolf populations are growing in Europe. And some question whether the wolf should remain protected under their version of the Endangered Species Act. Stollinger says the two continents can learn a lot from each other. In both cases, lines on a map will always be flashpoints. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Walkie in Carbon County.
Now, for another iconic animal of the West, the grizzly bear. Grizzlies are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, but some experts and landowners think one population in and around Yellowstone National Park should be considered recovered. Meanwhile, some environmentalists say in order for the grizzly population to be fully recovered, it needs more genetic diversity. One way to do that is by allowing grizzlies from a central Montana ecosystem to travel south and breed with bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem. The technical name for that is creating connectivity, but that 100 miles or so between the two ecosystems is populated with over 200,000 people. I visited two communities preparing for grizzlies. Last year, junior high school students in Alberton, Montana, had their school day interrupted for something unusual.
We did have one bear shot in Alberton last year, and it was right within sight of the school, and that really had an impact on the students.
That's Bob Summerfield. He heads up the Brovald Community Orchard in Alberton. He says last year there wasn't much natural food, so it was an especially bad year for bears in a community of about 400.
And so the fruit that we did have, the bears had to access it by climbing in the trees and getting the fruit. And so in the process, they broke a lot of limbs out of the trees and caused a lot of damage. So that was kind of the impetus.
Alberton decided they wanted to become a bear smart community. That means eliminating things in town that lure bears to wander in. And they started with the community orchard.
This is our brand new fence. And so far it's been 100% effective in keeping the bears out.
The community installed an electric fence in mid-August. That was in preparation for when black bears come into town, but also for when grizzlies arrive.
But grizzly bear populations are continuing to expand, and they will be here. It's not a matter of if they will be here, it's when they will be in town.
And when that happens, Summerfield says it will be a whole new ballgame. Alberton sits on the edge of the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem. It's prime grizzly habitat, but as more animals are populating the area, younger males are wandering further out looking for new territory.
We're already kind of getting into habitats that are less suitable for grizzly bears simply because there's more human activity on the landscape.
That's Frank Van Manen. He's a leader in grizzly bear research. He and other scientists have tracked grizzlies straying further away from protected habitats like Yellowstone.
You know, whether it's small towns, agriculture, human developments, roads, those are all factors that contribute to making areas less suitable for grizzly bears and creating a higher risk of mortality.
Basically, human-made attractants like garbage and fruit trees lure the bears into town. If the animal ends up relying on those food sources, they stay in populated areas for longer, and there's a higher chance for the bear to get killed, whether that's by accident or as a safety decision by wildlife officials. So these areas are less fit for animals to live in. Lori Roberts with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department says that's okay. These areas are meant to be connective zones, areas where bears can pass through to more livable ecosystems.
We're not looking to have bears in these connectivity zones be at crazy like population levels. We're not going to have 500 bears, but we do need those so that we can have natural, you know, connectivity and genetic movement between these ecosystems.
The two ecosystems are about 100 miles apart from each other, and over 200,000 people live between them. Robert says some towns in this region know that they are in this pathway and have started asking themselves questions.
Do you have any wildlife corridors that move through your community that would bring bears down there at certain times of years? And what does that look like? Going through your community and assessing what would be potential bear conflict areas.
Missoula, Montana, just 30 minutes east of Alberton, was one of those communities that asked themselves those questions. They realized the community of about 78,000 people has a lot of potential bear conflict areas.
So Greeno Park is a park that has a creek that runs through it.
That's Erin Edge. She's part of the Missoula Bear Smart program.
Bears frequent this park. It's also heavily frequented by people that live here, using it for just kind of hanging out by the creek, up to running, to walking, just to enjoying the outdoors.
Like Alberton's Bear Smart program, it's modeled after a program in British Columbia. The way it works is a community creates a working group that develops a step-by-step protocol of how to make a community bear-proof, says Chris Servine. He's another member of the working group there.
If we could solve the fruit trees, the bird feeders, the pet food, and the garbage, we'd have most of the issues solved.
So they created a conflict management plan based on those major attractants. That plan got the community involved through regulation, education, and awareness.
So we've got the city and the county unanimously now in favor of providing these regulations so that all the cans will be bear-resistant cans in the next 3 years. That's number one. That's 49% of the problem.
Meaning 49% of the bear conflicts in Missoula are from the animal getting into the garbage can. And the town did it. Recently, both the Missoula City and County passed regulations requiring garbage cans to be bear-resistant in the next 3 years. And they'll continue to work on decreasing those human attractants until the day the grizzlies start passing through. The key word there, keep those grizzlies passing through and not lingering in the area, munching on garbage or fruit.
The goal is to not go to the house that you can see from where we're standing right now and tip over their garbage and eat garbage and then decide, oh, you know what, that garbage is way easier, way tastier for me to get into than chokecherries.
It turns out to get that genetic diversity that some say the Yellowstone population needs to get off the ESA, it could only take one or two grizzly bears. Here's grizzly bear scientist Frank Van Manen.
It would only take one or two animals that come into the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, would breed with a Yellowstone bear, and then introduce genetic material from the Northern Continental Divide.
Van Manen stresses the Yellowstone bears are fine in the short term. The genetic diversity is really important decades or hundreds of years from now. But even so, it could happen quicker than we expect.
It might have already happened, and we just haven't documented it yet because our genetic analysis, you know, take a little bit of time to be completed.
Van Manen says these bear smart communities are key to making the connective route more accessible for the grizzlies. And that could be the final key to the Yellowstone grizzly bears getting removed from the endangered species list. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. When we come back, some of the lesser known species listed on the ESA. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to our 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act special on open spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The Wyoming toad is an endangered species native to the Laramie River Basin, but the critter was considered extinct in the wild in 1985. But thanks to the efforts of conservationists and Laramie community members, the species is beginning to make a comeback. Wyoming Public Radio's Suraj Singareddy reports.
That's one of our irrigation canals.
Fred Lindsay and his wife Stephanie call 140 acres of farmland just west of Laramie home. Their main crop is hay, but they're helping to grow something else too.
So you gotta ask yourself, can I find something about the size of a 50-cent piece or a silver dollar scrunched down to the ground and colored like the ground? The answer is, it's not easy.
He's talking about the Wyoming toad. The toad might be small, but it's easier to find it here than almost anywhere else. The Lindsays are part of a small group of landowners who are helping the endangered species make a comeback. Rachel Eric is the head of the Wyoming Toad Recovery Team. It's the main organization spearheading the recovery efforts. The toad is native to the Laramie River Basin, and just 50 years ago, it wasn't endangered at all. Eric says the amphibians were important to the local ecosystem, both as prey and predators.
And they also helped eat a lot of bugs. So I always tell folks, like, if there were big healthy populations of the Wyoming toad in Laramie, there'd probably be less mosquitoes around.
But by the 1980s, the population had begun to decline. The toads lost land, human development, and pesticides had harmful effects. The biggest threat, though, was fungus. Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, or BD, is an infectious disease that can be lethal to many amphibians, like the Wyoming toad.
There's actually 90 species that have just gone completely extinct due to BD spread and introduction.
The fungal disease flourishes in cool, wet environments, aka the type of environments that toads love. By 1985, the disease had run so rampant that scientists believed the Wyoming toad was lost forever. But then, at Mortenson Lake, a small surviving population was discovered and brought into captivity.
And those were the founders of our current population.
Conservationists spread a new generation of toads in zoos, labs, and hatcheries across Wyoming and beyond. But that would have all meant nothing without somewhere to release the toads back into the wild. That's where the Lindsays came into the picture. They're involved through something known as a safe harbor agreement, says Fred Lindsay.
They basically say, okay, we kind of like your land, and we think in this case, it may be suitable for the Wyoming toad.
All the agreement requires is that the landowner allows U.S. Fish and Wildlife to release the endangered animal on their land. They're not required to change how they use their land at all. However, many landowners are enthusiastic about toad conservation and end up going above and beyond. Eric says the Lindsays, for example, have helped the recovery team experiment with different habitats.
So we dug out little wetlands, that sort of thing, and changing like vegetation heights, things that we think may help the toads.
Besides habitat cultivation, the toad recovery team is also experimenting with genetic and bacterial ways to fight BD, also known as the chytrid fungus.
The Wyoming toad does offer a really unique experience just to develop and apply conservation techniques that could be useful for other amphibians worldwide that are negatively influenced by the chytrid fungus.
So far, the team's efforts seem to be going well. Last year, about 20,000 tadpoles and 1,000 adult toads were released in various locations. One of those locations is the Lindsay's Farm, where the toads are beginning to breed in the wild and recuperate without human help for the first time in decades.
When they lay their eggs, they kind of hang them on a piece of grass or brush or something and string them out. We've had tadpoles in here before, and toads calling during the breeding season.
And that season is when the toads are at their noisiest, like in this clip recorded by Jeff Rice. As long as that sound continues, experts estimate that the toad could be delisted as an endangered species as soon as 2030. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Suraj Singareddy.
The U.S. Department of the Interior recently announced the establishment of the Wyoming Toad Conservation Area. The area spans over 1,000 acres and is located west of Laramie. In addition to protecting habitats critical for the toad and other species, it will also be available for public recreational use. Scientists know very little about a species of stonefly that can only be found in the alpine streams of the Grand Teton mountain range. The Lednia tectonica was discovered in 2012, but as climate change slowly melts glaciers and threatens the aquatic insect's habitat, researchers are trying to learn as much as they can about the species before it disappears. Back in 2018, Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim went in search of the insect.
On a cold morning at a Grand Teton campground, three scientists are packing their bags for an expedition.
It's about 6 a.m. People are just starting to wake up, and we're heading to the Skillet Glacier later today.
That's Scott Hotelling, a postdoctoral scholar at Washington State University. He's alongside Lesha Tronstadt.
I'm the invertebrate zoologist at the University of Wyoming.
These scientists and a graduate student have been visiting sites around the Tetons for over a week, collecting data on a stonefly species unique to the mountain range. The Lednia tectonica. The small brown aquatic fly lives only in rock and surface glacier-fed streams. In the first leg of their journey to today's site, Skillet Glacier, the team jumps on a boat. For the last 4 years, a small group of researchers, including Tronstadt and Hotelling, has been racing to study the insect and the streams it lives in.
See the little handle going up?
It looks like a snow guitar.
Yeah, it's a snow guitar. And there's the stream coming out of it that we'll be walking up.
Okay, you guys ready?
Very little is known about what lives in these alpine streams. These scientists are the first people to really investigate what's there.
We call ourselves the Alpine Stream Dream Team.
And they think what they find might be important. With climate change heating up temperatures in the insect's habitat, the rush to learn about it pushes the stakes even higher.
Icy stream habitat goes away. This whole world goes away and is replaced by a warmer temperature community that is different. And that's a significant blow to global biodiversity.
After the short boat ride, the scientists head upward on the long, trailless hike. Hotelling explains after today and many more days like it, the team will have a huge collection of the basic natural history of the species, the insect's population density, the microbes in the water, and how the temperature changes annually.
We need these long-term data sets to fully clarify how these changes are happening on a year-to-year basis, or a decade-to-decade.
Already, the team has uncovered 9 new sites where the stonefly lives, out of only 10. After hours of bushwhacking through willows and climbing over boulders, the alpine streams come into view. Soon, Hotelling lifts up a rock and uncovers a small brown wriggling insect.
All right, here's one of the stars of our alpine stream show. This is Lednia tectonica right here. You see this little dark brown stonefly?
The insect clings to rocks as freezing water rushes past it. It's the size of an ant and sort of nondescript. Tronstadt explains this stonefly is important to its ecosystem by dealing with big organic matter like leaves, sticks, and moss.
And they usually shred those up and make them into smaller pieces, and other organisms can use them downstream, so.
They're also important because, as an indicator species, it's like a canary in a coal mine. As stoneflies start going away with warming waters, that means climate change could be having other impacts in the alpine stream ecosystem, and that affects water everywhere.
These are the headwaters of the world, and so everything that happens up here, all the organisms that live and die, all the water that flows out of a glacier, it all goes into Jackson Lake down here, and it continues until it goes out into the world's oceans.
Hotelling moves up and down the stream in search of 20 lednia to study later. Further down, the graduate student is brushing stones from the stream, collecting algae, fungi, and bacteria. Over time, her research will show how lednia food sources could be changing with the climate. 10 feet away, Tronstadt gathers data on the stream.
I was saying that there wasn't a lot of algae in the stream. You guys concurred?
She notes how much algae is in the stonefly's habitat, what rock sizes are there, pH, as well as what other insects are present to learn population density. While they still can, scientists are collecting this baseline data and will watch over the course of years as climate change transforms this world.
And watching, waiting, and collecting data every year is really the best thing we can do to figure out how this is all going to play out and end.
The next morning, after a steep downward hike from Skillet Glacier, a new question around the stoneflies is being addressed. If it can withstand warmer temperatures, some scientists have already learned it can, though not well. Hotelling says it's one more question they'll have to take on, and that's no problem.
We'll be back. I mean, that's definitely the only constant is we will show up next year.
There's more to learn about this tiny brown alpine species, and it could have bigger implications than the tiny stonefly itself. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Cooper McKim won a National Edward R. Murrow Award in 2019 for this story. A year after McKim went out with the researchers, the stonefly became federally protected under the Endangered Species Act, and researchers have since found the insect in new streams in the Wind River, Absorica, and Beartooth ranges. They're continuing to monitor the streams. Next, a species that's long been considered for protection and could be listed soon. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kodalska. We're looking back at the Endangered Species Act 50 years after it became law. Now, we turn to the greater sage grouse, whose total population has long been declining, and for many years, some have petitioned to list it as endangered, but to no avail. Wyoming has tried desperately to avoid that, as it could severely restrict development and energy production across much of the state. Since the early 2000s, Wyoming has tried to show the feds that it can manage the declining bird. Right now, that plan includes 15 million acres of core area, which limits development. And the state is proposing to add onto the map to once again convince the feds the bird doesn't need to be listed. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan spoke with Bob Budd. He's overseeing Wyoming's sage-grouse efforts and has been a part of it all since 2000.
Bob, thanks for joining us today. You have invested decades of your life with sage grouse, and it's obviously a very controversial topic. First of all, are you tired? And second of all, why do you continue to invest your time?
Well, do I get tired of it at times? Yes. I think it'd be a lie to not admit that.
Yeah.
But, you know, why do I do it? Because I care about the species. I care about our state. And because I've had three governors tell me you're going to continue to do it. That last one is probably more compelling than the others. But
yeah,
I mean, so it's a tremendous group to work with. In Wyoming, we all sit down at the table. We come up with solutions that work, that include people who are vested in it, whether that be a conservation perspective or oil and gas or mining or ranching.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what you guys have come up with this new strategy, the updates to the map. I know there's been several drafts and public comment. Give us kind of the updates.
A lot of people act like this is a brand new thing. The original map was done in 2008. And those maps are built off of where are the birds? What are the birds telling us? Where is the habitat? And where do we have opportunity for maintaining and improving habitat for the species, as well as dozens of other species that live in that ecosystem. And in 2010, we went back and looked at the originals and said, you know what? There are some things we need to make adjustments to. We did the same thing in 2015. Since then, we went back and said, all right, what is the information that we have now compared to what we had in 15? And as an example, if you go back to when we started in 2008, we had a very large coal bed methane play going on in northeast Wyoming. That has since ended. And so you have birds reoccupying areas. You have places where the birds are doing well that were not suited to be in core area at that time. And where are there areas that maybe don't fit being in core? And so that's just good, sound management, is going back and saying, what have we got right? What have we got wrong? How do we make adjustments? And that's what we're doing now as part of the process.
And so about how much extra land would be added into core areas? And then also, what does the process look like now? And when it goes to the federal government, what does that look like to get it approved and everything?
Well, first of all, I can't give you an exact number of acres because the governor hasn't looked at the new mapping and made a decision. But it would be somewhere in the realm of 500,000 acres are under consideration.
Okay.
And that's out of 15 million plus that are already in. That's not a huge percentage. It's an adjustment. But the number of birds in that 400,000 to 500,000 acres is fairly significant. So how that plays into the federal process, the bird is the state's bird, not the federal government. And as a consequence, we are the ones who will say, look, these are the areas that should be managed in Wyoming for sage grouse.
And is there any possibility of the federal government not accepting this plan? And if so, what would happen then?
Does that possibility exist? Of course it does. I hope that doesn't happen.
Do you know what would happen if it did?
Well, I think we'd probably all have a bunch of lawyers lined up.
Gotcha. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the pushback. I've heard from some people that they don't want to see the map change. I've even heard people feel like we're kind of bowing down to the federal government by adding on to the core area, and that potentially this could even infringe on private property rights or energy development. What's your response to people who are kind of upset?
We've been managing with core areas now for, almost 20 years. And we do respect private property rights. There are a whole host of de minimis practices that relate to agriculture and ranching that are allowed because they're in the normal context of those operations. We have developed oil and gas in core areas. We have developed other minerals. We have done that because it's been done responsibly. And you have people who are following a very strict protocol of avoiding conflict, number one, minimizing impacts, number two, and where necessary, providing for compensatory mitigation. The vast majority of what's been done has followed only the first two because there has been no need for compensatory mitigation. So we've basically found ways to avoid conflict and impact. That may be things like co-location of activities on lands that are already disturbed or development of travel management plans that limit the need for additional roads. So there are any number of things out there that we have been able to accommodate under the existing core area strategy. So I think that a little bit of those fears are misplaced. I do understand them. But as far as kowtowing or caving to federal pressure, it's our map. We developed the map. They didn't. They'll have their own maps and people can see what they think of that.
And then the other side of the coin, there's people that feel like this map isn't going far enough. I've heard from some people, they feel like it's too accommodating to industry and that sage grouse need even more protection. What would be your response to them?
Basically the same thing. This is based on the science of where the birds are and the areas that they are using. And, there are people who would like to take the entire state of Wyoming and black it out and say, this is all for sage grouse and for nothing else. That's not going to work. It is a balance. Anytime you do this, and particularly when you do like we do in Wyoming and involve all of the affected parties, there are going to be compromises. And there are going to be areas that some people think should be in that aren't. There are going to be areas in that people think shouldn't be in. But at the end of the day, it's the best judgment of a wide variety of people who have a chance to weigh in, provide input, and provide their expertise.
Last question, Bob. How concerned are you that the greater sage grouse would be listed under the Endangered Species Act?
Well, I mean, I'm concerned about it because I think that there are any number of, number one, you have to look at how the assessment will be done. The way that the petition has been done is across its range, which is 11 Western states. So everything we do in Wyoming that's right is affected by something that happened that goes wrong in another state, whether that's a management issue, which generally is not the case, or a wildfire issue, or other things that are affecting that species, those all affect us because they're in other states. So I have a concern about that. Am I concerned about the future of the bird in Wyoming? No, I'm not. I think that there are things that we are doing and will continue to do that will help to secure that species, barring something like a massive disease or parasite or asteroid or something like that. I think that we are doing a great job. I'm not worried about the bird in Wyoming. I am worried about what may happen if you get a listing.
Well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Bob Budd. He's the chairman of Wyoming's sage-grouse implementation team. Thank you, Bob, for joining us.
You bet. Have a great day.
Thanks for joining us for today's special 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act on Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The show can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News. Thank you.